You're listening to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Thursday, the 7th of September. Oh, what a beautiful morning, was written by Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein for the musical Oklahoma. And Hammerstein was moved to say about it, "I know the world is filled with troubles and injustices, but reality is as beautiful as it is ugly. I think it is just as important to sing about beautiful mornings as it is to talk about slums. I just couldn't write anything without hope in it." For 71 years, Cleveland has been home to a literary award that recognizes the ugliness humans often inflict on each other, but that also celebrates the hope and beauty of searching for understanding. That prize is the Annisfield Wolf Book Award, which was created in 1935 to honor writers who advance the cause of diversity in all its many shades and forms. The 2006 winners gathered tonight at the Cleveland Playhouse to receive their awards in a ceremony that is already full to capacity. Today around noon, we are very pleased to welcome those writers to our Idea Center studios. Later this hour, we'll meet the nonfiction prize winner, Jill Lepore, and Lifetime Achievement recipient, William Demby. But we begin with the prize winner for fiction, Zadie Smith, whose highly praised novel, On Beauty, has just been released in paperback. Zadie, welcome to Around Noon, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
You grew up in Northwest London, the daughter of a Jamaican mother and an English father. I was wondering about your feelings on ethnic identity growing up. Did you feel tension or confusion being pulled in different directions?
Well, you know, the thing that people maybe don't understand about experience is you can only live the one you have. So though I was often asked that, certainly by white people when I was growing up, as if my birth was necessarily a confusion to me. But of course, it was the only one I knew. So it was perfectly normal to me to have one black parent and one white parent. It was going to other people's houses where I thought it was unusual to see two white parents, two black parents. That was more exotic to me. I think the only place where tension comes in communities where what blackness is very, very, a very, very thin concept. That's the only problem I ever had. Whenever you're being told that to be black is only to be these various things, then I had a difficulty. But as long as the concept is as large as it is to be human, then it's fine.
Hmm. You changed your name as a teenager from Sadie to Zadie. And I was curious about how becoming Zadie better fit with how you saw yourself.
Well, you know, the actual reason for that is almost endlessly misreported. I was in love with a boy whose name began with a Z, and I had an idea that maybe if I changed my name to a Z, I could help things along a little bit. I was 13. It was a very silly idea. And it wasn't until I came to America and I found out my name means grandpa in Yiddish. So it was a strange change.
Zadie does.
Yeah, but in the end, it's been useful because when it's on the front of the books, it feels somewhat separate from me, I guess.
Hmm. The story of your journey to being a published novelist is kind of that struck by lightning experience that most young writers dream of. I want to have you explain what happened.
I always feel strange at talking about it because I think it's such terrible advice to young writers. And what happened to me was so accidental and happens, you know, once every 4 years. It's a kind of freak event. And it was partly the result, I think, of maybe Arend Hartie Roy, who'd had an enormous success the summer before. And so I suppose publishers were looking for, I don't know what, somebody ethnic. I guess that's how they think about it. I was very young and I'd sent a manuscript off to an agent and it was just taken. You know, there was no long process. But I think that's far from the reality of most writers' lives. And actually, I spent a lot of time feeling oddly guilty about it. But I think now I just keep on doing my work and try not to think how I got started.
Yeah. And it seems interesting that so much buzz was around it, even just based on one chapter. It wasn't as if they were reading a whole book.
Yeah, it was a strange situation. I mean, a lot of people, I sent it blind. I think when people read it, they thought it was a man, and then they thought it was a white man, and then I think they were surprised to find out, I suppose, my age and my ethnicity and my gender. So maybe that was what the added fuss was. But you know, I always felt from the very beginning that I was going to pursue a long career as far as I could manage it, and that in the end, only your work counts, and all the rest of it just is newspaper clippings. It falls to the wayside.
Mm. The book we're talking about, that first book, was White Teeth, and it became an immediate bestseller. And as you were talking about age and gender and ethnicity, the book touched on all of those things and more. Do you think that look at all kinds of diversity was what people found so compelling?
Well, you know, on my part, it was quite unconscious because my life and the way I grew up was naturally that. And I never considered it, you know, the way people talk about multiculturalism these days, as a policy or as an agenda or as an argument or as a debate. And to me, it was just a reality. I never considered it as something that had to be pushed or argued for or defended. I just thought it was a natural result of immigration, which, of course, it is. You know, once people learn how to fly and go into boats, it was always going to happen. There's no way of returning that process. So I was slightly surprised by what a talking point that part of the book was, because I suppose that was just my backdrop. I never really thought about it that much.
Do you think people in England and in America both talk too much about it or not enough?
Well, it's completely different situations. Like reading Jill Lepore's book, who's on next, I was reading that last night, and to understand the background of race in America, it's a completely, you know, toxic relationship. There's no comparison. On the European continent, obviously there was slavery in England, but on this scale and this incredibly bloody and miserable history. So the two things to me are apples and oranges. It's very hard to talk about them together. And the English experience is very different, but it has its own complications. It's in no way a kind of paradise for race.
In your latest book, On Beauty, you again address diversity on all those levels. And as you've said, it's you're writing about what you know, what you've seen. I wanted to have you lay out some of the storyline of the book and all the different kinds of levels of life it looks into.
Well, the story is quite hard to summarize because there's too many people in my books. But basically, it's about a white professor who's married to a black woman for 30 years. A happy marriage which has turned a little sour. They have three children. They live on campus in a sweet university town. And it's kind of about how Howard is dragging his family down. Or he's at a crisis point in his life where he has to make a choice about whether he wants to stick with the life he's been living so far or whether he wants to jump ship, you know, and start again with somebody new, somebody younger. And so it's about marriage a great deal. That's what I was thinking about when I was writing it. And I just got married and... when you do get married, you realize it's, on one hand, a simple enough institution, and on the other hand, an extraordinary metaphysical event. You know, you have to tie your wagon to another person's wagon for what is meant to be the rest of your life, and that's an incredibly profound act. So I wanted to try and kind of shoot into the future and wonder what it would be like to deal with a marriage that long.
Mm. Would you share some of the book with us?
Absolutely. This is The Three Children of Howard and Kiki, who've bumped into each other in the street after a gap. The Belsey children repaired to a nearby cafe. They sat on stools lined up against the window pane, looking out over the blasted heath of Boston Common. They caught up with each other's news casually, leaving long, cosy gaps of silence in which to go to work on their muffins and coffees. Jerome, after 2 months of having to be witty and brilliant in a strange town among strangers, appreciated the gift of it. People talk about the happy quiet that can exist between two lovers, but this too was great, sitting between his sister and his brother, saying nothing, eating. Before the world existed, before it was populated, and before there were wars and jobs and colleges and movies and clothes and opinions and foreign travel, before all of these things, there had been only one person, Zora, in only one place, a tent in the living room made from chairs and bedsheets. After a few years, Levi arrived. Space was made for him. It was as if he'd always been. Looking at them both now, Jerome found himself in their finger joints and neat conch ears, in their long legs and wild curls. He heard himself in their partial lisps, caused by puffy tongues vibrating against slightly noticeable buck teeth. He did not consider if or how or why he loved them. They were just love. They were the first evidence he ever had of love, and they would be the last confirmation of love when everything else fell away.
The words of Zadie Smith, read by Zadie Smith. They come from her book On Beauty, a book for which she has won the Anisfield Wolf Book Award Fiction Prize. That prize will be awarded in a ceremony this evening at the Cleveland Playhouse. And Zadie joins me today in Studio 4 of the Idea Center at Playhouse Square. Zadie, as we touched on earlier, the book draws all sorts of characters who try to get inside each other's heads from different classes and cultures. And another sort of diversity you address in the book, which I often don't see in books when you're thinking about those kinds of things, is size. Kiki Belsey has become a very full-figured woman, and I wondered about thoughts that you had on beauty and body type in various cultures.
Well, it's a few things. I used to be very big myself my whole life until I got out of my late teenage years. So it's interesting to know what it is to be in both bodies and how the world treats you and how people react to you. And I felt the difference very strongly, and then I resented the difference very strongly, I think, when I became more slender. It irritated me, and it proved a lot of things that I'd suspected when I was a child. Also, you know, there's lots of things that people say which have become kind of slightly cliched about the black community being more willing to accept difference and bigness in their women. There's certainly, I think, when I think of my mother and her social life, an idea that I'm just a little girl and she's a woman. There's a difference there. And they each have values, but being a woman has a different power. So I think that is true, and not just a cliche. There is truth in it. But I guess when I'm writing, the thing which matters to me most is, you know, a lot of books are about what it is to be black or what it is to be a woman. I'm most interested in giving people, whether they're black, big, female, the right to have a much more existential question. What is it to be? You know, it's not only white men who get to move through the world wondering about their existence. And I feel often when you talk about those kind of issues in fiction, blacks, women, people who are large, whatever it is, they're being dragged down and restricted by this identity, supposedly, of theirs, whereas white people are allowed to move through the world asking much larger questions about their existence. So I guess that kind of annoys me, and I want to give my characters the freedom to ask the most profound questions about what it is to be alive, not just what it is to be in this particular skin or in this particular gender.
And one thing that struck me about the book is the voice that you speak in as the narrator. It's not as detached as you would think of as someone writing in the third person. And I wonder what choices you make there.
Well, a lot of it is influenced. Some of the writers I've loved most, because I'm an English writer, I guess there's a lot of Austen and Dickens and people like that whose mm-hmm. third person voice was very inflected, depending on which character they were touching. And then people like Zora Neale Hurston, for instance, who was overtly attached to some characters and disgusted by others, and I find that quite humorous, and it's a kind of moral voice in the narrative voice which I like. It doesn't push the reader into opinions. The reader still has their freedoms, but I like the idea of a writer saying at certain points, well, this is what I believe. Yeah. Here it is reflected through this character, so I am attracted to that.
Yeah, it made for a much livelier read, because you get the sense that the writer, the person who's speaking, is as invested as the people who are living these lives.
And also, the objective narrative voice is a phony. You know, there's no such thing as this kind of a voice come from above to show you a world that seems to exist independently of the writer. It's not true. I made the world. They're part of my thoughts. They're part of me. So I don't mind that inflection so much. So I know other people who are much more Puritan about it.
And in the book, there's also a poem which is professed to be written by one of the characters, and it is the On Beauty that's found in the title. But it made me wonder, reading it, if it was a lament for what people see as beautiful, or if it's something else.
Well, my husband wrote that poem mainly because I guess we were thinking about the same ideas at the same time, and we'd read a book of philosophy called On Beauty and Being Just, which inspired this book and I think inspired my husband's poem. And I think we were both thinking about beauty as, you know, one of the reasons for getting up in the morning in that kind of William James mystical way. And I think both my husband and I are quite overawed every day by the extent of beauties. But then the other question of beauty is always, the fact that you see it, are you lucky to see it? Is it because of your natural advantages, your money, your home? You know, would you be seeing the same amount of beauty in the world if you were suffering, if you were struggling? So beauty is always a double-edged question in that way. And also that whenever you define something as beautiful, you block out many other things in the world which seem to be less beautiful or less deserving of beauty. So it's a strange concept because it seems to sum up everything that's good, worth living for, worth dying for, and then everything which also restricts and stops and excludes people. So I think his poem is about both of those things. It's double-edged side.
Yeah. Well, at the risk of confusing things even more, I think the book is full of beauty, and I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. My guest has been Zadie Smith, who is the winner of the Fiction Prize for the 2006 Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. Her acclaimed book on beauty is out now in paperback, and it's published by Penguin Press. Tonight, Zadie receives a prize at the Cleveland Playhouse alongside nonfiction winner Jill Lepore and Lifetime Achievement winner William Demby. For more on all of the winners, log on to today's Around Noon program schedule online at WCPN.org. Coming up, the fight for liberty in 18th century Manhattan ends in flames. We uncover a story lost to the sands of time with nonfiction winner Jill Lepore and look forward to talking with William Demby later in this hour as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
Support for NPR programming on 90.3 comes from WCPN listeners and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
It's the perfect time to celebrate Fall Fest at the Holden Arboretum. Fall Fest features a variety of family activities, a farmer's market, the magical Green Machine Trail, concerts for adults and children, and staff-led tours. Enjoy lectures and demonstrations with garden ideas for new woody plants. Celebrate the harvest season at Holden Arboretum, Saturday and Sunday, September 16th and 17th. Visit holdenarb.org for details.
This is 90.3 WCPN. Idea Stream.
Welcome back. You're tuned to a special edition of Around Noon as we welcome the winners of the 2006 Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. The award ceremony is tonight at the Cleveland Playhouse with winner Zadie Smith for fiction, Lifetime Achievement winner William Demby, and nonfiction winner Jill Lepore. We've heard from Ms. Smith. Mr. Demby joins us later. And right now we welcome Ms. Lepore, the nonfiction winner for her book, New York Burning. The Anisfield Wolf Book Awards honor writers who celebrate diversity and also who document racism. Jill Lepore does the most, does the latter, as she charts a forgotten story from the biggest, most diverse city in the United States, a story of race and rebellion, a story that Lepore argues changed the face of American politics forever. Jill Lepore is with me now in Studio 4 at the Idea Center to tell us more. Jill, welcome, and to you, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Your book takes place, as we mentioned, in Manhattan in 1741. How did you come across this story, which seems probably not familiar to most people?
Well, the story is that in 1741, after a series of fires erupted across Manhattan in a few short weeks, the white citizens of the city decided that the fires had been deliberately set by the city's slaves. And not many people know, but New York was a slave city. One in five New Yorkers was enslaved. And in the course of the winter and spring of 1741, a series of trials were held in which 13 black men were ultimately burned at the stake and 17 more were hanged. And 4 whites were also hanged as the ringleaders of what a grand jury concluded was a grand conspiracy of the city's slaves to burn the city down and murder all the whites. And I came across this story because the trial transcripts survive. All of the men who were arrested were actually brought to trial if they refused to confess. And very careful trial minutes were taken by the Supreme Court of New York, which held the trials.
So were you looking specifically for this story? I mean, had you heard of it in some other form, or were you just doing general research and said, let's look at 18th century Manhattan?
I guess I just came across it. I've been very interested in understanding how people justify cruelty and how people explain racism to themselves on all sides. And these trial transcripts just kind of jumped out at me from some anthology, I think, that I came across where a little excerpt was printed. And I went back and I looked at the originals and I realized it's this massive book, 250 pages of trial transcripts and confessions and depositions and testimony that really no one had used. In fact, most historians had pretty much thrown this away because the confessions of 200 black men were arrested and over half of them confessed to conspiring to burn the city down. And the confessions were so obviously coerced. These guys were thrown in a dungeon for months. They were probably beaten badly. And their choice was confess or be burned at the stake. So it's hard to view these confessions as really reliable in any sense. And so for good cause, historians had thrown them away. But I felt, wow, we just have so little. We know so little about 18th century slavery. We know a lot about the 19th century and the antebellum. You think about the plantation South, and that's when we think of slavery. That's what we tend to think about. And I thought, gosh, these documents tell so much about northern slavery, slavery in New York City, urban slavery. It's a completely different world. And maybe there's a way we can learn from these confessions something about these guys' lives, even if we don't learn whether they were guilty or innocent of trying to burn the city down. Gosh, you know, I don't think we can afford to throw these sources away.
Mm. I want to know more about those lives because I'm trying to picture how these men were used in this urban setting.
Well, you have to sort of, first of all, just jettison from your mind everything that you're thinking about when you're thinking about, you know, Jefferson's plantation and Monticello and the slave quarters and hundreds of slaves living outside of the big house. New York City is a dense, cosmopolitan city in the 18th century, 10,000 people, 2,000 of them enslaved Africans. They live with their owners, so maybe one or two slaves in any household. And they live, you know, in the kitchen, or they sleep in the kitchen, or maybe there's an attic room or a cellar. Very intimate experience of slavery. The women who are living with their children, most cases, are doing domestic work. And the men go to the docks every day. There's no agricultural work for them to do. This is a very urban environment. New York City in the 18th century is one of the most bustling places in the Atlantic seaboard. And the guys, they go to the docks every day and are hired out to load and unload ships or to do errands across town. One of the big things they do is go get fresh water from water pumps on the outskirts of the city because the water in New York is terrible for drinking. And tea has become the fashionable drink. So all these wealthy white New Yorkers, Englishmen and Dutchmen, Frenchmen, want to have nice water for their tea. And they send their slaves all across the city to get tea water. So one of the things that's so interesting and I found so compelling about the lives of these guys is they're all friends. Like this 2,000 black men, women, and children living in New York, they all know one. You can know 2,000 people. You know, you can, you see them at the water pump every day. You go sleep with your wife at night. You maybe live, you know, a few blocks away, but New York is very small. You can walk there. You can see your children every day. There's a real intimacy and a real vibrancy to the community of enslaved people in New York that I just came across in these documents in incidental ways. One of my favorite moments was reading a confession of a guy named Quack who was, you know, confessing to this, you know, script that you had to confess to. I was going to burn the city down. I was going to murder my master. But then he named as a co-conspirator a friend of his. And so the interrogator said, well, how do you know this other guy? And he said, well, we used to play marbles together when we were kids. And it's completely, there's no reason for him to make that up.
Right.
But you see in that, he had a childhood. He had games that he played. He played English games, which is interesting. Maybe they're African forms of playing marbles as well. He had friends. He had friendships that lasted a lifetime. Just that one little throwaway line, we played marbles together as kids, just unravels a whole world.
You make a point of a specific quote, liberty and slavery. How amiable is one, how odious and abominable the other. What struck you about that those lines?
18th century Englishmen were obsessed with the difference between liberty and slavery. They wrote about it all the time. That line comes from James Alexander, who's a lawyer in New York. He's a Scottish lawyer. He's a slave owner. And he is paraphrasing English political theorists who write with great eloquence about the devastation, the social death that is the state of slavery. And yet Alexander found no contradiction in his desire to realize his own liberty and his felt need to own slaves. And I'm really interested in understanding how early America was both the birthplace of the world's first modern democracy and the last bastion of chattel slavery. It's what historians call the American paradox. How can we understand anything about our society unless we understand how people could hold those two ideas in their heads at the same time? Did they not think they were contradictory? Did they come up with some way of reconciling them? How is it possible that we can explain that when these people could barely explain it to themselves? And I was very compelled by trying to reckon with that and thinking about the story of New York.
And could you? I mean, were there places where you could bring together why they were able to?
I think what I was able to understand, and this is borrowing from Orlando Patterson, who's a brilliant sociologist who's written a lot about the relationship between slavery and freedom, that demands for political liberty, calls for political liberty, have only ever been made in human societies where there is slavery. It's, in fact, the observation of the degraded state of slavery that makes people value their own freedom. So if you look at ancient Rome and ancient Greece and every place you look where new kinds of political liberties are realized, they're slave societies. And it's a terrible truth, but it's important to think about what that means and what that means for the American story and for the myths that we tell about ourselves, and to see the ways in which, and what I see in New York is the way that slavery makes liberty possible. It's the way in which this, and not just that the work that slaves do gives these white guys the leisure to come think about their liberty, but actually it makes them think about their liberty. It is responsible for the very singular embrace of the ideas of freedom that sparked the American Revolution.
I wanted to have you share something from the book, and then we can talk a bit more about what we've just heard.
Okay, great. I'm going to read a passage from the beginning of the book, where I'm trying to set the scene for where the slaves confessed to having conspired. When they confessed, they all said the same thing. We went to John Huston's tavern and we conspired there. And this is my attempt to kind of write a composite of those confessions as if they were true, trying to imagine that scene. The guests began arriving at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a bitterly cold Sunday in January 1741. They came from all over the city. Bastian trudged up from Jacobus Vark's bakery on Broad Street. Captain John Marshall's slave Ben headed north on Broadway and then west to Gerardus Comfort's dock, where he called out to Comfort's slave Jack, "Brother, go to Hewson's." In the Trinity churchyard, Emmanuel, owned by a cordwainer named Thomas Wendover, met Quash, who worked at a brewery on Maiden Lane, and together they walked along the waterside, staring out at the meringue of ice on the Hudson River, to John Hewson's tavern, on the edge of the city. And what I was trying to do there, it sounds like a lot of names all kind of crushed together in a single paragraph. But what I found in reading the trial transcripts, at the very back of the trial transcripts is an appendix, which is a list of all the men and a handful of black women who were arrested and their fates and their masters' names, their owners' names. And that's all you sort of know about them. And I stared at that list and stared at that list and stared at that list, and I thought, gosh, what can I do with this list of names? That's all I know about these men. And I want to make more of them. I want to tell their story. And the more I looked at the list, the more I realized that this list is actually the single best surviving census of a slave community north of Maryland in all of the 18th century. You know, there are 200 names. And I went about finding everything I could find out about each of these guys, looking at their confessions, who accused who said that he met somebody at some market one day, who played jacks with somebody, who played marbles with somebody, who was married to someone else's sister, to try to weave them into a social world, weave them back into the social world that they actually lived in. And so in writing the book, I use these guys' names a lot and talk about their owners and what their owner's occupation was. This guy was owned by an English butcher, and this guy was owned by a Jewish merchant, and to try to put them in a place and take this census and build the world back up.
Exactly. And I should mention once again, that is Jill Lepore, who is the author of New York Burning, Liberty, Slavery, and Conspiracy in 18th Century Manhattan. Tonight, Jill receives the Annisfield Wolf Book Award for Nonfiction, and she joins us today in Studio 4 of the Idea Center at Playhouse Square. Jill, your chapter headings are interesting. Ice, fire, paper, stone, and later blood and dust. What were you going for in those headings?
I think I was trying to make sure to call my readers' attention very early on to the importance of description and the reconstruction of this world, the importance of this as a place. The story starts in the middle of the winter. The ice is really important. That everybody is frozen and can barely move around the city is important to how things transpire. When the fires happen, to pay attention to just how dangerous fire is in an 18th century city, to really ask my reader to wrestle with what it means to live in a wooden building in a small city where there's no firefight, basically almost no firefighting technology, and cities are destroyed by small fires. And to get all the way to the end of the story, to dust is I was quite compelled by, as I think many Americans were, by the discovery in Manhattan of an 18th century burial ground that was accidentally unearthed during excavations for a building in Lower Manhattan, and those remains and what archaeologists and anthropologists did in studying with them, thinking about those bones as a way that the story survives and gets told, or the artifacts that are associated with those bones. Because when trying to study the history of slavery, the history of African Americans, there's so many problems with not having enough evidence as a historian to think about the kind of evidence you need to make an assertion, and think about trying to call my readers' attention to how things get erased.
And as I'm thinking about all the facts and statistics that you've turned into sort of a story that kind of brings those numbers to life, I'm wondering what it means to you to receive an award like the Annisfield Wolf for this book.
I'm just delighted about this award. I just feel so pleased to have the work recognized in this particular way, and I hope that it does honor to the award to think about the importance of history. There's a lot of kinds of nonfiction that wrestle with the problems of race and contemporary society, but I feel very strongly that Americans can't go forward and think about race relations unless we understand our past better. And so I'm just delighted at the recognition for a historical project in particular.
And we thank you so much for sharing it with us. Jill, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Jill Lepore, the author of New York Burning, Liberty, Slavery, and Conspiracy in 18th Century Manhattan, published by Knopf. Tonight, she accepts her Annisfield Wolf Book Award for nonfiction before a capacity crowd at the Cleveland Playhouse. And joining her will be fiction winner Zadie Smith for On Beauty and Lifetime Achievement winner William Demby. For more on all the winners, log on to today's Around Noon program schedule online at WCPN.org. Coming up, we take a trip to the catacombs with Lifetime Achievement winner William Demby as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
The Cleveland Council on World Affairs presents John Podesta, former Clinton Chief of Staff and current Center for American Progress CEO, on September 13th at 6 p.m. at the club at Key Center. Podesta will speak on Reclaiming Control, a Progressive Approach to National Security in the 21st Century. He'll propose a new strategy to combat security threats from terrorists, global warming, weak states, and nuclear weapons. Information available at ccwa.org, sponsored in part by IdeaStream.
For hundreds of years, people have been predicting that the end of organized religion was near. But in some places, that threat of doom may be refueling its revival.
Since the Intifada in the Middle East has started, you have insults in the streets. You can be beaten up in the street just because you're a Jew.
The life is different than what we had when I was a child.
Tune in for Worlds of Difference, The Spirit Calls, Friday night at 10 here on 90.3.
It is 15 minutes before 1 o'clock as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3, where tomorrow we raise a glass to Pink Martini as we share an interview with the musicians of this international troupe prior to their performance for the Cleveland Museum of Art. I'll also enter the blogosphere of road warrior Andrew Harrison, who's traveling the country talking to Americans about their choices and passions in life. Plus, the new art space of Parish Hall in the Detroit Shoreway District. And regular irregular guest Andrew Grams of the Cleveland Orchestra shares stories from the European tour. All tomorrow around noon on 90.3 IdeaStream. There's a school of thought that when it comes to being a writer, one should live first, write second. The real experiences of life are the fodder for the best fiction, whether it's Ernest Hemingway or Ralph Ellison. Tonight, my next guest receives a prize for both the pages he penned and the days that inspired them as he accepts the Annisfield Wolf Lifetime Achievement Award at the Cleveland Playhouse. William Demby has lived a life of the writer, whether it has been his time as a reporter for Stars and Stripes during World War II, translating the screenplays of Federico Fellini in his adopted home of Italy, or penning his classic about life in segregated West Virginia, Beetle Creek. Joining me now in Studio 4 of the Idea Center here in Playhouse Square is the 2006 Annisfield Wolf Lifetime Achievement winner, William Demby. William, congratulations and welcome.
Glad to be here.
You were born in Pittsburgh on Christmas Day, but grew up in West Virginia. I wanted to have you just sort of set the scene a bit about the place you grew up. What did it look like? What did it feel like? What did it live like?
From Pittsburgh to West Virginia? Well, you're right. It was an entirely different world. And in Pittsburgh, I lived on a street in which all of the white ethnic groups were lined up like a parade of flags. There were a lot of Polish, Irish, German, English, and Scotch-Irish, and so forth and so forth. And when the ragman would come down the street, all the kids would run behind the ragman yelling, "Christ killer, Christ killer." When I went to West Virginia, I must say I was pleased because time had slowed down. And I was in a town which was not exactly a small town, but it was in another historical period. It was quiet, and it was more folksy. And I was pleased because I was living with black people for the first time. I mean, I was surrounded by people who were middle-class black people like my family was. And I felt that I had come back somewhere. And I had a great feeling of comfort and a feeling of I belonged here at this time.
You went on to attend West Virginia State College, where you took a writing class taught by Margaret Walker. Are there things that you recall from that class that are still part of your makeup as a writer?
Yes, that was one of the major experiences of my life. I wrote a story for my teacher, and it was about something I imagined in Pittsburgh during the Depression. I was would be crossing the Point Bridge, and a man would be about to jump over the bridge out of desperation, and I would say something to him, and he would not jump out over the bridge. I wrote a story something like that, and my teacher began to cry. She wept, and she said, "If only I could write like that." That's mm-hmm. what she said to me. And that kind of changed my attitude toward writing, because I didn't know what it was that made her cry. But I knew that there was some secret power to writing that could make that happen.
College was interrupted by World War II when you joined the Horse Cavalry serving in Italy and Africa. What kind of experience was it for you traveling in Europe? Well, not traveling, but actually fighting first, and then but then making that your home.
Well, being in the army and in Italy was a fundamental experience. First of all, to experience war not as cannon and bombs going off, but as the lives of ordinary people being changed very violently around you, even as you looked. And while you would see that middle-class life is not necessarily safe and eternal. And what we were witnessing was the experience middle-class people were having, Italians were having at wartime, being without food and sometimes having to do things to earn money to get food that were not what you would expect from middle-class people. It was a very sobering experience. But then we began to bond with the Italian people, and that liberated all of us, and it changed my life because I wanted to come back to Italy after the war.
I'm talking with William Demby, who is the Lifetime Achievement Award winner for the Annis Field Wolf Book Award, and he accepts his award this evening before a capacity crowd at the Cleveland Playhouse. William, you wrote your masterpiece, Beetle Creek, in Italy, about life in segregated West Virginia. Was it easier for you to write about West Virginia away from it?
Yes, because now I had been deeply exposed to real life. And there's none of the subterfuges we had as I was growing up, things being hidden from you, the vulnerability of middle-class life, things falling apart. All of those things that middle-class Americans struggled to keep from their children. In Italy, I saw what real life was. I saw tragedy. I saw hatred. I saw small ambitions overrunning safe behavior. And I was able to look at the life that I witnessed as though it were a theater, and then to write about it, and to write about it with deep, deep insight. But I don't think I would have been able to write that novel had I not gone to the war in Italy, and then later wrote the book in Italy.
Mm. You've brought with you a copy of your second novel, The Catacombs, and I would love to have you read something from it, because it's a book that's acclaimed for your unusual use of language, and then we can talk a bit about mm-hmm. it. Would you like to share something from that book?
Well, yes. The Catacombs is an experience in writing in which I combine things that are happening in my own life, the same timeline, with things that I read about in the newspaper, and with a fictional life of a fictional character. And For example, this is a good, I'm going to read this if I may now. This is a small segment of the novel in which I have just come back from the March on Washington, and I am telling the fictional character in the novel about what I felt and trying to let her, make her understand. She's an American girl, a black young girl who is marooned in Italy. She's a dancer, and I am telling her what I've experienced during the March on Washington. It was incredible, Doris, the high pitch of hatred and violence I felt in New York, in America. As soon as I got back from Washington, it was as if some satanic supersonic whistle were being blown, one of those high-frequency whistles they used to call dogs with, but one so big it was driving people to the point of madness all over the United States. The TV stations broadcast two-hour specials about the Freedom March. And hatred against Negroes grew. I went to a black Muslim meeting in Harlem to hear Malcolm X speak, and he raved and ranted against white people and against the Uncle Toms who had let themselves be sucked into participating in the Freedom March. He urged the crowd to buy black Muslim bean pies and warned the black women present that if integration of the races took place, the white women were already mobilized to steal all their black men. Two black women in the crowd standing next to me began shrieking, "Blood! We want blood! Kill the cops! Kill the cops!" They thirsted for blood. Then, on a Sunday afternoon, my sister phoned me from Alabama to tell me that someone had thrown a bomb in a Negro church in Birmingham, killing five young girls who were attending a Sunday school class. And the supersonic dog whistle inciting the nation to violence grew stronger and stronger. And 2 days before President Kennedy was assassinated, I almost got into a fight with a young Irish boy in an Italian bar.
The words of author William Demby, the winner of the Lifetime Achievement Award for the Annis Field Wolf Book Awards, and he'll receive his prize tonight. He joins us today around noon. William, I believe you haven't written a novel since 1979, Blue Boy. It made me curious about how you've been feeding that writing muse in the years in between then and now.
I didn't feel a novel taking place. I am now in the middle of a novel that has come to me. But in the intervening period between the catacombs, I had a lot of catching up to do with my own life. That is, I had tragedy. I had death in close to me. I was living, and I was, however, working in the Italian film industry as someone who translated dialogue for all of the classic Italian films. So I was actually engaged in another form of writing, and it was not difficult to take up writing a novel again.
I'm so glad that a new set of readers is being exposed to your work again. It's writing that once again illuminates culture and diversity and mm-hmm. understanding, and so much appreciate your sharing it with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been William Demby, the 2006 Lifetime Achievement winner of this Annis Field Wolf Book Award for tonight. Tonight at the Cleveland Playhouse, William and the other winners, Zadie Smith and Jill Lepore, accept their awards before a standing room only Bolton Theater crowd. For more on the Annis Field Wolf Book Awards and this year's winners, just log on to today's Around Noon program schedule online at WCPN.org. Tomorrow around noon, we enter the blogosphere of road warrior Andrew Harrison, who will write about the passions that he's found on the road, plus the new art space of Parish Hall, and we make a toast to Pink Martini and find out what's happening with the Cleveland Orchestra on the road. Today, our thanks to technical producer Jeff Carlton. Our executive producer is Mark Rosenberger, and Around Noon is produced by Dave DiOrio. I'm Dee Perry, inviting you to stay tuned for the next hour, in which you'll hear the BBC's World Have Your Say, the daily interactive show where you set the agenda. That's between 1 and 2 here on 90.3 Idea Stream.
Partial funding for the production of Around Noon at 90.3 comes from the Cleveland Foundation and the George Gund Foundation. Additional support for 90.3 comes from BrightNet Internet Providers. And 90.3 salutes Cleveland State University's role to help encourage the entrepreneurial spirit in local high school students by sponsoring a business plan competition and scholarships.
Who have been isolated